It's a really striking statistic when you think about it. The Kurdish population, somewhere between what, 30 and 45 million people.
Yeah, huge.
And they're one of the world's largest stateless nations. So you naturally think about their identity, their place in the Middle East, and, well, the relationship with Islam comes up, right?
Absolutely. It seems like it should be straightforward.
Exactly. But as we've been digging into the sources you provided, the reality is, well, it's anything but simple, much more nuanced.
That's right. The main document we looked at, Kurdish Islam, History and Diversity, it really forces you to look beyond those easy labels.
Yeah, it does.
And your goal, as we understand it, is to get a really solid grasp on this specific topic, efficiently, but without just skimming the surface, moving past the generalizations.
That's the plan. So the core of this deep dive today is exactly that, the intricate, really multifaceted connection between the Kurdish people and Islam. And we need to say right off the bat, well, yeah, the majority are Sunni Muslim. That's honestly just the beginning of the story.
It really is. And there's this other idea that floats around sometimes,
Oh, yeah.
that maybe Kurds hold their Islam lightly or aren't as devout as others in the region.
Right, I've heard that kind of thing.
And look, there might be historical factors, cultural elements, maybe pre-Islamic influences that feed into that perception. But the danger is that it kind of overshadows just how profound and, frankly, enduring the influence of Islam has actually been on Kurdish life. We're talking over 13 centuries here.
Okay, so that perception might miss the mark quite a bit. Let's unpack this properly then. To give everyone listening a clear map, we're going to first look at how Islam actually arrived and spread in Kurdistan.
And it wasn't a single event, as we'll see.
No, definitely not uniform. Then we'll explore the different branches, the different sort of flavors of Islam practiced by Kurds.
Including Sufism, which is hugely important.
Yes, we'll definitely get into Sufism. And then how Islam has shaped Kurdish culture, identity. And finally, that really dynamic interplay between religion and politics in Kurdish nationalism.
It's a lot, but we'll really try to distill the key takeaways, pull out the memorable details, give you a clear understanding without drowning you in information.
Sounds good. So let's start right at the beginning. The arrival and consolidation of Islam in Kurdistan. Now, before Islam showed up, the region wasn't exactly empty religiously, was it?
Oh, not at all. Before the 7th century, the Kurdish areas had this really diverse mix. A lot of it was rooted in Western Iranic traditions. Think pre-Zoroastrian,
Okay.
these older Indo-Iranian beliefs, worship of nature, maybe some dualistic ideas. They were pretty influential. And elements of them, they kind of persisted subtly, even after Islam became dominant.
So they didn't just disappear.
No, and that's what's fascinating. You see echoes, blendings, syncretism, really, in later traditions like Yazidism, Yarsinism, even Kurdish Alevism. It shows this kind of cultural
Like
resilience.
layers being built up over
Exactly.
time.
And it was even more complex than that. There were Jewish communities, Christian communities, too.
Right.
In fact, there was this Kurdish kingdom, Adiabene, near modern Erbil. Its royal family actually converted to Christianity way back in the 5th century.
Wow. Okay. So Islam arrived into a place with a really long history of different faiths interacting.
Precisely. It wasn't a blank slate.
So, 7th century, Islam arrives. How did that initial contact happen? Was it peaceful, violent?
Well, the first major contact came with the early Arab Muslim conquests. As the armies pushed out from Arabia, they ran into Kurdish tribes during the conquest of Mesopotamia around 637 AD,
Okay.
and then during the campaigns against the Sasanian Persian Empire. Now, the Kurds were a big part of the Sasanian setup, and initially they actually fought alongside the Sasanians against the Muslim advance. This was between about 639 and 644 AD.
So the first interactions were mainly conflict.
Largely, yes,
Yeah.
military conflict. It wasn't an immediate embrace.
Right.
But even in the middle of all that fighting, the records mention some very early individual conversions, like figures such as Jabana Kurdi and his son Maimun. They're often considered the first Kurds to accept Islam.
Really? That early?
Yeah, and some stories even say they became missionaries themselves. There's also Khalil al-Kurdi as-Samani, noted as an early follower, a Tayyun who learned directly from companions of the Prophet Muhammad.
So, alongside the big battles, there were these personal connections happening too, as the old Sasanian power crumbled.
Exactly. It shows it was complex from the get-go. Not just conquest, but individual choices, too.
Okay, so that's the initial contact. What about the wider process, the actual Islamization of the Kurdish population? Was it quick?
Well, that's where things get debated. There are really two contrasting narratives. One suggests a pretty early, relatively swift mass conversion, maybe during the time of Caliph Umar in the mid-7th century.
Okay.
The thinking there is, you know, the Sasanian Empire was clearly losing, so Kurdish tribal leaders pragmatically decided to submit to the winners, except to Islam, and their tribes just followed along. Some sources even imply most Kurds were Muslim by the 8th century, and importantly, without losing their Kurdish identity or language in the process.
That sounds neat. Maybe too neat.
Well, that's the counter-narrative. It argues for a much longer, sometimes coercive, and definitely resisted process.
Coercive.
How so? Historical sources talk about early military campaigns aiming to convert and or tax everyone they could find. There are accounts of Kurdish groups being told, basically, accept Islam or pay the jizya, the tax, on non-Muslims.
Under threat of attack.
Yes. Medieval writers like Ibn Athir even mention polytheist Kurds being killed or enslaved for refusing Islam. So this view suggests Islamization took centuries, maybe not really finishing until the 9th, 10th, or even later in some isolated areas.
Centuries is a huge difference. What backs up that longer timeline?
Several things. You have reports of non-Muslim Kurdish communities hanging on in remote mountain areas as late as the 13th century.
Wow.
Some Kurmanji-speaking tribes actually have oral traditions saying their conversion only happened about 300 years ago, driven by their chief's political calculation.
Politics again!
Always. And of course, the simple fact that distinct non-Islamic faiths like Yazidism and Yarsinism survived, keeping their own traditions despite centuries of living alongside Islam.
Yeah.
That strongly suggests the process wasn't total or uniform.
Right. They weren't just absorbed.
Exactly. So the reality was likely very mixed, different speeds, different pressures, different outcomes across different regions and tribes over a long period.
Okay. So not a single event, but a long, complex process shaped by pragmatism, belief, resistance, and force, varying place to place. Now, once Islam did become established, what about institutions like madrasas? How important were they?
Oh, hugely important. Madrasas, the Islamic schools, became absolutely central to Kurdish civilization after Islamization really took hold.
More than just religious schools.
Much more. The first known Kurdish one was maybe mid-10th century in Hamadan. Yeah. But they evolved into these vital centers for broader intellectual and cultural life.
Kind of like early universities.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially under someone like Saladin, who was Kurdish, of course. Under his influence, the curriculum expanded quite a bit.
Beyond just religion.
Definitely. Quran, Hadith, Islamic law were the core, naturally. But they also taught logic, governance, math, astronomy, medicine, even philosophy.
That's quite comprehensive.
It really suggests a period where Kurdish madrasas fostered a very broad approach to knowledge.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is that Saladin apparently emphasize Kurdish lessons within these madrasas.
So using the Kurdish language for instruction.
Alongside Arabic, yes.
Hmm?
Texts were translated into Kurdish for use in the schools. This highlights their role not just in Islamic education, but in preserving and developing the Kurdish language itself within that framework.
That's fascinating. So they were nurturing Kurdish literary culture too.
Absolutely. And you see the results in early Kurdish scholars and writers, people like Balsami Kurdi back in the 9th century, Ali Hariri in the 11th, even a notable female scholar, Fakhrunnisa, around the 11th, 12th century, and later the historian Abul Feda.
So they were contributing to the wider Islamic world too.
Big time. And this tradition had legs. Even after Turkey secularized in the 20th century, some saw Turkish Kurdistan as kind of a bastion of this traditional Islamic education.
So the madrasas were key for knowledge, intellectual life, Kurdish culture, and knitting society together within that Islamic context.
You've got it. Crucial hubs.
Okay, so Islam arrives, establishes itself, madrasas play a big role. Let's get into the different branches and schools of thought now. You mentioned the Sunni majority, but that it's not monolithic.
That's absolutely right. About, say, 75% of Kurds are Sunni Muslims. But the defining feature, really, is the dominance of the Shafi school of law.
And why is that significant?
Well, it sets them apart from many other Sunni neighbors, Turks, Arabs, who mostly follow the Hanafi school.
Right.
This preference for Shafi law has fostered a distinct legal culture among Kurds. It can affect interpretations of things like family law, inheritance, maybe how local customs interact with religious law.
So real world differences.
Potentially, yes. Now, while Shafi is dominant, there is a Hanafi minority among Sunni Kurds, too. And interestingly, in southern Kurdistan, the KRG area in Iraq, the Hanbali school is also said to be quite widespread.
Hanbali too. Okay, so quite a bit of diversity just within the Sumi fold.
Exactly. And historically, there was even a tiny Zaidi Shia presence, though that seems to have faded.
Okay. What about Shia Islam among Kurds? You mentioned it's a minority.
Yes, roughly 10 to 15%. The most prominent group are the Feli Kurds.
Feli Kurds, where are they mainly found?
They're concentrated mainly in those southeastern border areas where Iraqi Kurdistan meets Iran. Places like Khanakin, Mandali, Badra. Historically, they were in big Iraqi cities, too.
And what branch of Shia Islam?
Today, it's predominantly Twelver Shia Islam, the main branch in Iran, though there's some evidence of other Shia groups in the past.
And being on that border, that must be complicated.
Very. It creates this really interesting dynamic. Religiously, they're linked to Shia Iran, but ethnically, they're Kurds, connected to other Kurds across the region. Puts them right at an intersection of geopolitics, ethnicity, religion.
Yeah, you can see how that would play out. Okay, another really significant element is Alevism, particularly in Turkey, right?
Absolutely. Alevism adds another major layer of religious diversity, especially among Kurds in Turkey. It's often described as a syncretic faith.
Syncretic meaning?
Meaning it blends elements from different traditions. In Alevism's case, you see influences from Shia Islam, definitely Sufism, and also pre-Islamic, perhaps ancient Anatolian or Iranic traditions.
Okay. What are some core Alevi beliefs or practices?
There's a deep reverence for Ali, the Prophet Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, and the 12 Imams recognized in Twelver Shia Islam. Haji Bektash Feli is also a key figure. The central ceremony is the Sem.
The Sem.
Yes. It involves ritual gatherings with music, especially the saz, a type of lute, sacred hymns or discourse, and often a distinctive whirling dance called the Sema. The language used can be Kurkish, Kurdish, or Zazaki.
Sounds very distinct. How many Alevis are there, and how many are Kurdish?
Estimating numbers is tricky, especially in Turkey, where Alevism isn't officially recognized as distinct from Islam. Estimates for the total Alevi population range wildly, maybe 4% to 25% of Turkey's population. Often people settle around 10, 15%.
And the Kurdish portion.
That's also debated. Figures range from maybe 20% of Alevis being Kurdish or Zaza speakers up to potentially a majority. It's hard to pin down.
Where are Kurdish Alevis mainly concentrated?
Primarily in Turkey, especially in regions like Dersim, now called Tunceli, which is often seen as the heartland, but also Alezik, Muz, and surrounding areas. And there's a significant diaspora in Western Europe, too.
And they face particular challenges, don't they?
They often face what's called double discrimination. As Kurds, they face pressure from Turkish nationalism, and as Alevis, they face non-recognition and sometimes prejudice from the Sunni majority and the state, which historically hasn't acknowledged Alevism as a separate religious identity.
So marginalized on two fronts.
Exactly. Mm. And partly because of this, many Kurdish Alevis tend toward secular viewpoints and left-leaning politics, often seeing it as a defense against perceived state bias towards Sunnism and political Islam.
Okay, that adds another really important dimension to the picture in Turkey. Now let's pivot to Sufism. You mentioned its importance. Can we really dive into that?
Yes, definitely. Sufism, the mystical tradition within Islam, has been incredibly influential in Kurdish society. It's not just about personal spirituality. It's deeply woven into the social fabric, culture, even politics.
Which Sufi orders are most prominent?
Among Sunni Kurds, two orders have historically dominated, the Naqshbandiya and the Qadira.
Okay, tell us about them.
The Naqshbandiya tends to emphasize adherence to Sharia, Islamic law, and practices like silent dhikr, or remembrance of God. It saw a huge expansion in Kurdistan thanks to a figure named Maulana Qalib Baghdadi in the early 19th century. His specific branch, the Qalidiyya, became deeply rooted.
Right, and the Qadiriyya.
The Qadiriyya traces its lineage to Abd al-Qadir Jilani, who, interestingly, many Kurds believe had Kurdish origins in southern Kurdistan. The Qadiriyya often involves more ecstatic rituals, perhaps more outward expressions of devotion, compared to the Naqshbandis.
And the leaders, the sheikhs, they were powerful figures.
Immensely powerful. Their influence often went way beyond religion. They were frequently also tribal leaders, mediators in disputes, figures who held communities together. Leadership often became hereditary, passed down in families.
So a combination of religious authority and social power?
Exactly. Their followers, or murids, showed intense loyalty, viewing the sheikhs not just as teachers, but as spiritual guides, sources of blessing or baraka. This gave the sheikhs huge social capital.
And how did Sufism interact with other religious currents, like Yazidism, for instance?
That's a fascinating example of interaction and evolution. Take the Adawiyya order. He was founded by Sheikh Adi ibn Safir, who was likely an Arab Sufi who settled in Lalish in the 12th century.
Lalish, the holy site for Yazidis now.
Precisely. Over time, his order seems to have blended with local, pre-existing beliefs in the region. Through this syncretic process, it evolved into what we now know as Yazidism. So Yazidism retains some structural elements reminiscent of a Sufi order, but its theology became distinctly different. It shows how Sufism could interact with and transform existing local traditions.
Wow, that's a complex history. So beyond spirituality, how did Sufism shape Kurdish society? And you mentioned resistance.
The organizational structure of Sufism was key. In the society often fragmented along tribal lines, the Sufi orders created networks through their schools, madrasas, lodges, texts, and the shared loyalty to a sheikh that could cut across those divisions.
Creating wider bonds.
Exactly. Building solidarity. And this structure, this ability to mobilize followers loyal to a sheikh, gave them significant potential for political action.
Which they used.
Frequently.
Hmm.
Especially during periods of resistance against outside control, whether it was the Ottoman or Qajar empires, or later, modern nation-states like Turkey or Iraq, trying to suppress Kurdish identity or autonomy.
Can you give some examples?
The most famous is probably the Sheikh Said Rebellion in Turkey in 1925. Sheikh Said was a Naqshbandi sheikh, a hereditary leader. His role was explicitly framed, at least partly, as defending Islam against the new secular Turkish Republic. But it was also deeply tied to Kurdish nationalism and defending traditional authority.
So religion and nationalism intertwine.
Very much so. You also see Naqshbandis historically defending Ottoman Sufi identity against, say, Wahhabism. Or, much later, during the Iran-Iraq War, another Naqshbandi sheikh in Iraqi Kurdistan, Sheikh Mohammed Uthman Siraj al-Din, formed a militia called the Salvation Force to fight against the Islamic Republic of Iran, framing it in jihadist terms.
So a recurring pattern of Sufi leadership in political and military action.
Yes. Now, arguably, the overt political dominance of the big Sufi orders might have diminished somewhat with the rise of modern secular nationalism and general modernization.
Right.
But they remain incredibly important cultural forces.
Right.
And in some places, like post-2003 Iraq, you've actually seen a resurgence of some orders, like the Khaznazani order, getting involved in politics again.
So their influence continues, maybe in different ways.
Absolutely. The legacy of Sufism as a force for social cohesion, cultural identity, and political resistance is just undeniable in Kurdish history.
Okay, that really highlights the depth of Sufism's role. Now, we've touched on Yazidism and Yarsinism as examples of syncretism and survival. Can we look a bit closer at this broader religious tapestry beyond mainstream Islam? Let's start with Yazidism.
Right. Yazidism is an ancient faith, really indigenous to the Kurdish regions. It's a fascinating blend. You can see traces of pre-Zoroastrian Iranic beliefs, Mesopotamian traditions, maybe some Jewish and Christian influences, particularly Nestorian Christianity, and as we discussed, Islamic Sufism, likely evolving from that Adawiya order.
A real melting pot of influences. What are some core Yazidi beliefs?
They believe in one transcendent God, but also in seven holy beings, or Heftsir. The preeminent one among these is Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel.
Who has sometimes been misunderstood, right?
Tragically misunderstood, often misidentified by outsiders with Satan, which has led to horrific persecution over centuries. Yazidis also have a unique belief about their descent from Adam, but not from Eve, which underpins strict rules about marrying only within the community.
Endogamy.
Yes, and a hereditary caste system, sheikhs, peers, and yurids. Conversion into or out of the faith is traditionally prohibited, and there's a strong emphasis on religious purity involving certain taboos.
And their main holy site.
The shrine of Sheikh Adi in Lalish, in modern-day Iraq. There's a major annual pilgrimage there.
And the persecution has been severe.
Horrific. From Ottoman campaigns in the 19th century, often carried out with Kurdish tribal participation, sadly, right up to the ISIS genocide in 2014 in Sinjar. Mass killings, abductions, sexual slavery. Just devastating.
And the relationship with Kurdish identity itself is complex.
Very complex and often contested. Many Yazidis identify strongly as Kurds, sharing language and culture. Others, especially perhaps after the genocide, emphasize a distinct Yazidi ethno-religious identity separate from Kurds. There have also been political pressures like past Arabization attempts in Iraq or current tensions sometimes with the KRG. It's a very sensitive issue.
Understandably so. Okay, what about Yarsinism, also known as Ali Haq or Kakai?
Yes, another indigenous syncretic faith deeply rooted in Kurdish culture. It was likely founded or reformed by Sultan Sahak in the late 14th century, primarily in the borderlands between modern Iran and Iraq.
And who follows it?
Followers are mainly drawn from specific Kurdish tribes like the Guran, Sanjabi, Kahor tribes in Iran, and the Kakai in Iraq. The There are also connections to some Turkic-speaking groups and the Shabak community in Iraq. Population estimates vary wildly, from 500,000 to maybe 3 million.
And their core beliefs.
Key tenets include belief in successive manifestations, or masariyat, of the divine essence, with Sultan Sahak being the central figure for the current epoch. There's also a belief in the transmigration of the soul, or dunaduni. They distinguish between an inner, hidden reality, batini, and the outer world, zihiri.
Are there influences from Islam, too?
Yes, definitely influences from Shia Islam, particularly a reverence for Ali, which led to outsiders sometimes calling them Ali Alahi, those who deify Ali, though they generally reject that label. And Sufi influences are clear, too, like the practice of dhikr.
How is their religious life practiced?
It revolves around sacred texts, like the Kalam-e Saranjam, primarily written in the Guarani dialect of Kurdish. The central ritual is the jam ceremony, similar in name but distinct from the Alevi one, involving ritual sharing of food and water and the singing of sacred poems, kalam, often accompanied by the sacred tanbur lute. Like Yazidism, they also have hereditary religious lineages called Sayeds.
So another complex faith with deep Kurdish roots facing its own pressures.
Exactly. Strong ties to specific Kurdish tribes in the Guarani language, but facing pressure in Iran due to their non-Shia identity and displacement and challenges in Iraq.
Okay, we should also briefly mention Christianity among Kurds. It has ancient roots, right?
Very ancient, predating Islam significantly. We mentioned the Kingdom of Adiabene converting in the 5th century. Early on, Aramaic was a key language, and Nestorian Christianity was prevalent in the region.
Did many Kurds remain Christian after Islam arrived?
It seems so, for quite some time. Medieval sources like Masudi and even Marco Polo mention Christian Kurds. There were notable Kurdish converts who rose to prominence in Christian states, like Nasser the Kurd, also known as Theophobos in Byzantium, or the Zakarid family, who became powerful vassals in Georgia and Armenia.
But over time, assimilation happened.
Largely, yes. It seems many Christian Kurds were gradually assimilated into larger Aramaic-speaking, Assyrian Syriac, or Armenian Christian communities. Then, starting around the 15th century, European and American missionaries became active, leading to some conversions, including among Yazidis.
What about today? Are there Christian Kurds now?
Yes, though the numbers are relatively small, maybe tens of thousands, primarily in Turkey and the diaspora. It's a mix of descendants of older communities and significantly more recent converts.
Converts from Islam?
Yes. There's been a small but notable trend, particularly in recent decades. Some are drawn perhaps by disillusionment with political Islam or extremism. Others may be seeking a connection to pre-Islamic or non-Islamic Kurdish heritage. You see the emergence of evangelical Kurdish-speaking churches, like the Kurdsman Church of Christ in Erbil, for example.
So a small but perhaps growing phenomenon.
It seems to be, yes.
Yeah.
Adds another layer to the contemporary religious landscape.
And finally, in this diverse picture, we have to talk about secularism and non-religious trends. Is that significant among Kurds?
It definitely is. Many observers note that a lot of Kurds, particularly perhaps in the diaspora or certain political movements, appear principally secular. Maybe Islamic practice is less strict or less visible compared to some neighboring societies.
Why might that be?
There are several potential factors. Some point to the historical experience of being oppressed by states or groups who used Islam to justify that oppression. Others suggest the endurance of strong pre-Islamic cultural norms or the influence of modern secular ideologies, especially within nationalist movements. You sometimes hear arguments about, say, greater freedoms for women in some Kurdish context reflecting this.
And is it growing? Are people identifying as non-religious?
Anecdotally, yes. There seems to be an increasing number identifying as atheist, agnostic, or just non-affiliated. This might be intensified by disillusionment with the violence and extremism carried out by groups like ISIS in the name of Islam.
And the political context matters here too, especially in Turkey.
Hugely. Turkey's history of radical secularism after the Ottoman Empire, while aimed at creating a secular Turkish state, has complex effects. It alienated many religious Kurds, pushing some towards Islamist responses later on, but it also influenced the development of secular ideologies within the main Kurdish political movement there.
Like the PKK.
Exactly, and groups linked to it. And as we mentioned, Kurdish Alevis in Turkey often actively embrace secularism as part of their identity and political opposition.
So it's a real mix. Secular trends alongside deep Islamic roots and active Islamist parties.
Precisely. It creates this really dynamic, sometimes tense ideological landscape, a constant negotiation between historical roots in Islam and Sufism and modern secular or non-religious viewpoints.
Okay, that paints a really rich and complex picture of the religious landscape. Now let's focus specifically on how Islam itself has imprinted on Kurdish culture and identity. How did it shape traditions in daily life?
Well, the adoption of Islam, predominantly the Sunni Shafi form, profoundly shaped social norms and structures. But it didn't just erase what was there before, it interacted with existing Kurdish traditions like patrilineal kinship systems and tribal structures.
How so, in practical terms?
Think about family life, personal status, marriage practices like arranged marriages or the payment of bride wealth, hairmar, reflect Islamic influence. The local customs play a huge role too. Limited polygyny is permitted by Islam, but often constrained by economics and practice. Divorce procedures also generally follow Islamic law, though again, local customs can modify things.
And what about things like gender roles?
Traditional gender roles, especially in pastoral or agricultural economies, definitely exist. Islam has general prescriptions, but often the socioeconomic realities of Kurdish life probably had a stronger day-to-day influence than specific theological interpretations. It's a blend.
And leadership. You mentioned the sheikhs.
Right. Historically, there was often this fusion of tribal leadership, the agas, with religious legitimacy, especially embodied by the Sufi sheikhs. They held both worldly and spiritual authority. Modernization has eroded some of that traditional structure, but the legacy is still there in social customs and family relations. Islam is deeply embedded.
How did Islamic law, Sharia, interact with Kurdish customary law? Or did one just replace the other?
No, it was more complex. Islamic law itself actually has a concept called urf, which acknowledges custom. It distinguishes between valid custom, urf sahih, and corrupt custom, urf fasid. And the principle is that valid custom, stuff that doesn't directly contradict a core principle of Sharia, can actually supplement it, especially in areas where Sharia isn't explicit.
So it allows for local variation.
Exactly. It facilitated a kind of legal pluralism. This likely allowed many Kurdish traditions related to tribal governance, honor codes, hospitality rules, conflict mediation methods to continue alongside Sharia as long as they weren't deemed corrupt. The Shafi school, dominant among Kurds, is sometimes seen as being relatively flexible in considering local context, which might have helped this process of mutual accommodation.
So, a blending of religious law and local tradition.
Yes, a practical working relationship, most likely.
And what about language and literature? We touched on madrasas using Kurdish. How else did Islam impact Kurdish intellectual life?
It had a huge impact. Islam connected Kurds to the wider Islamic civilization, its scholarship, its texts, but it also acted as a stimulus for expression in Kurdish.
We mentioned the early scholars writing in Arabic or Persian, but contributing as Kurds.
Yes, figures like Basami Kurdi, Ali Hariri, Fakhrunnisa, Abul Fida, they were part of the broader Islamic intellectual world. But then you also see the development of vernacular religious learning in Kurdish, especially in early modern times. The madrasas played that key role we discussed.
And language was important for the other groups too.
Definitely. Think of the Yorsani sacred texts, the Kalami Sadanjam, being primarily in the Guarani dialect, or the Alevi traditions often being transmitted orally in Kurmanji or Zazaki. Language and religious identity are deeply linked for these groups as well.
So Islam acted as both a bridge to the wider world and a catalyst for developing Kurdish language and literature within a religious context.
That's a good way to put it. It connected Kurds to broader intellectual currents while simultaneously fostering distinct religious and scholarly traditions in their own language. So Islamic practice became deeply intertwined with Kurdish linguistic and cultural identity. Okay, this leads us naturally into the complex relationship between religion, politics, and nationalism. How central has Islam been to Kurdish political movements historically?
Historically, very central. Islamic identity and religious figures, mullahs, and especially those powerful Sufi sheikhs we talked about, were often key to mobilizing Kurds, particularly against external control.
Why the sheikhs again?
Because they had that unique combination of religious authority and established social networks through their orders. They could command loyalty and organize people across tribal lines in a way few secular leaders initially could.
We mentioned Sheikh Sayyid's rebellion.
Yes, 1925 in Turkey, a prime example, explicitly invoking Islam against secularism, mobilizing conservative religious followers, but also tapping into nascent Kurdish nationalism and defending traditional power structures. What about in Iraq? With someone like Mullah Mustafa Barzani.
That's interesting. Barzani, leader of the KDP, obviously had the religious title Mullah, and his family had links to the Naqshbandi order.
Yeah.
But his movement, over time, largely evolved into a secular nationalist one, focused on autonomy and Kurdish rights rather than primarily religious goals.
So a shift towards secular nationalism there, but Islamist movements also emerged.
Oh, yes. You had groups like Kurdish Hezbollah in Turkey, initially more pan-Islamic, later perhaps more Kurdish-focused, but violently opposed to the secular PKK.
Right.
And we mentioned that Naqshbandi led militia fighting Iran. The rise of Kurdish Islamism can be seen partly as a reaction against the oppression Kurds suffered under officially secular regimes in Turkey and Iraq.
So a reaction to secular state oppression sometimes fueled religious politics.
It seems plausible, yes.
Yeah.
It added another layer to the motivations.
This points to a major tension within Kurdish nationalism itself, right? The secular versus Islamist currents.
Absolutely. Kurdish nationalism is definitely not monolithic. You have strongly secular, often leftist strands. You have explicitly Islamist strands. And you have more moderate or traditional nationalist forms trying to navigate between them.
When did secular nationalism become prominent?
Really took off in the mid-20th century. It was partly a reaction to the exclusionary nationalisms of the states. Kurds found themselves in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria. And it was influenced by global trends like anti-colonial movements, socialism, etc.
And key secular groups today.
The PKK in Turkey and its affiliates, like the PYD in Syria, are the most prominent examples. Their ideology is explicitly secular, leftist, rooted in democratic confederalism.
And on the Islamist side?
You have established parties, particularly in Iraqi Kurdistan, like the Kurdistan Islamic Union, KIU, and the Kurdistan Islamic Group, KG, now Justice Community. They explicitly seek to blend Islamic principles with Kurdish national aspirations.
How do the big traditional parties, KDP and PUK, fit in?
They operate primarily within secular frameworks, though they have different ideological leanings, the KDP more conservative nationalist, the PUK more social democratic.
Hmm.
But both have to be sensitive to religious sentiments within the population.
Mm-hmm.
They try to navigate that space. Then you also had reformist movements like Goran in Iraq, also largely secular.
So it creates internal tensions.
Definitely. There have been periods of cooperation, but also significant tension and even violent conflict between secular and Islamist Kurdish groups, particularly in the past between the PKK and Hezbollah in Turkey or sometimes within Iraqi Kurdistan. This question of whether national identity or religious identity comes first or how to synthesize them constantly shapes Kurdish politics.
And how have the states Kurds live in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria? How have their policies toward Islam and Kurds shaped this whole picture?
Oh, the state context is absolutely crucial and it varies hugely.
Let's take Turkey first.
Turkey's dominant ideology has been secular Turkish nationalism. Historically, this meant denial of a distinct Kurdish identity, suppression of the language, culture, and sometimes overt religious expression if it seemed linked to Kurdishness.
But the AKP government, an Islamist-rooted party, changed things.
It's been complex. Under Erdogan's AKP, there was an initial period, a peace process, where Islamic Brotherhood was sometimes invoked to bridge the gap with Kurds. But later, especially after the process collapsed, the focus shifted heavily back to security, nationalism, and often using religion in a way that aligns with Turkish state interests. So it's a mix of security concerns, nationalism, and pragmatic engagement.
Okay, what about Iraq?
Iraq saw brutal repression under the monarchy and especially the Ba'ath Party, culminating in the Anfal genocide against the Kurds. Since 2003, you have the Kurdistan Regional Government, KRG, with significant autonomy.
And their approach to religion.
The KRG constitution refers to Islam as a main source of legislation, but also guarantees rights for religious minorities. It's often presented as a relative haven compared to the rest of Iraq, but challenges remain. Especially for minorities like Yazidis, Christians, Kakais, regarding discrimination, access to rights, and political representation.
Iran, how does the Islamic Republic deal with its Kurdish population?
Iran is different again. It's officially a Shia Islamic Republic. This creates an immediate religious division. Shia Kurds might share the state religion, but still face ethnic marginalization. Sunni Kurds face both religious discrimination and ethnic marginalization.
So double pressure for Sunni Kurds.
Yes. And generally, Iran severely suppresses Kurdish political aspirations and is harsh on non-Shia minorities like the Yarsin. There's also significant economic neglect and political repression in the Kurdish regions. Plus, Iran actively uses its Shia networks to exert influence regionally, sometimes impacting Kurdish areas in Iraq and Syria, too.
And finally, Syria.
Before the civil war, Syria was under Ba'athist Arab nationalism, officially secular, but heavily suppressing Kurdish identity. The war changed everything.
Leading to Rojava.
Yes, the de facto autonomous region in the northeast, often called Rojava, now formally the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, AAMI. It's led primarily by the PYD and its allies in the SDF. Their model is radically different. Explicitly secular, pluralistic, promoting democratic confederalism and coexistence among Kurds, Arabs, Syriacs, and others, with guarantees for religious freedom.
A stark contrast.
A huge contrast to the surrounding states. But they face immense challenges. Pressure from Turkey, the ongoing conflict, relations with the Assad regime, internal governance issues.
So Kurds are navigating vastly different political and religious landscapes depending on the country.
Absolutely. The KRG in Iraq and Rojava-Ionis in Syria represent attempts at self-governance with very different models for managing religious diversity. And these contrast sharply with the more assimilationist or repressive policies they often face in Turkey and Iran.
That really drives home the importance of the specific state context. Let's try to synthesize this with a quick regional comparison. Turkey.
Key tension. Secular Turkish nationalism versus a largely Sunni Muslim Kurdish population, plus that significant Alevi minority facing the double burden. Resistance has been both secular, PKK, and sometimes religious, like Sheikh Sayed. AKP's approach has been, well, changeable.
Tehran.
KRG autonomy, dominated politically by Sunni Kurds. Main challenge is managing internal diversity. Shia Falis, Yazidis, Christians, Kakais, Shabaks, and the complex relationship with Baghdad projects an image of tolerance, but minorities face real issues. Sufism remains culturally quite visible.
Iran.
The Shia state ideology creates that fundamental split between Shia Kurds, sharing religion, facing ethnic issues, and Sunni Kurds, facing both religious and ethnic discrimination. Severe suppression of political rights, pressure on heterodox groups like Yarsan, economic neglect.
In Syria.
Pre-war suppression under secular Arab nationalism. Now the ANA is promoting a secular, pluralistic model in the Northeast. A radical departure, but under constant threat.
So while there are cross-border Kurdish ties, the political expression of Kurdish identity and its relationship with Islam really diverge based on the state they're in, its ideology, autonomy levels, and the specific religious mix within that region's Kurdish population.
Exactly. You can't understand Kurdish politics or religion without looking at that specific state context.
Wow. Okay. So let's try and wrap this up. What are the absolute key takeaways?
I'd say first, the relationship between Kurds and Islam is profound, deeply historical, but incredibly complex. No easy summary works.
Right. Not just Sunni Muslims.
No. You have the Sunni Shafi majority, yes, but alongside significant Shia, Alevi, Yazidi, Yarsani, Christian communities, plus growing secular trends. Second, the Islamization process itself was long, varied, not just a simple conversion moment.
Got it.
Third, Sufism's influence has been immense socially, culturally, politically. Fourth, there's that constant interplay between Islamic law, Sharia, and Kurdish customary law, Urf. Fifth, the dynamic tension between religious and secular forces is central to modern Kurdish society and politics.
And
crucially, the policies of the states Kurds live in have dramatically shaped their experiences and how religion and politics intersect for them. And because of that, there are huge regional variations.
As you can see, everyone, understanding the Kurdish relationship with Islam is so much more than just knowing a demographic fact. It's really a journey through centuries of history. It's a complex tapestry of beliefs, and it's absolutely key to understanding the political realities of the region today.
It really is fundamental.
So maybe a final thought to leave everyone with. Considering this intricate interplay of faith, identity, and politics we've discussed, how might the internal religious diversity within the Kurdish people shape their future aspirations, perhaps for self-determination, and also their relationships with all the diverse nations around them in the Middle East?
That's a great question to ponder. How does that internal pluralism become a strength or maybe a challenge moving forward?
Something to think about. We really encourage you to delve deeper into any part of this that caught your interest, maybe the history of Sufism or the current challenges for Yazidis. Consider how these deep historical dynamics continue to shape today's world.
There's always more to learn.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Thank you. It was fascinating.